Welcome to today's edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In addition to feature reports, I'll bring you a look at regional and national agricultural news. And the show starts with a look at California agricultural news.
Early registration for the 2024 Crop Consultant Conference, hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and Western Region Certified Crop Advisors, is now open. The popular event for certified crop advisors, pest control advisors, grower applicators, and industry professionals is the mainstay for all continuing education needs this year and will take place on September 25th and 26th at the Visalia Convention Center. Visit myaglife.com/events for the early discounted rate of $275 per person, which includes the live conference, a trade show with 70 plus exhibits, first class dining, entertainment, and a mixer. We'll see you there.
Resurrected for the first time in decades last year by an epic deluge of winter rain and snow, by spring, Tulare Lake had reappeared, covering more than 100,000 acres, stretching over cotton, tomato, and pistachio fields and miles of roads. Tulare Lake was once the largest freshwater body west of the Mississippi before it was drained for agriculture in the 19th century. While it has reemerged during other periods of wet weather, the lake had not been seen anywhere near this scale in 40 years. Its resurrection brought in visitors and news coverage. Scientists and officials predicted the lake could remain for years to come, sparking consternation among the local farmers whose land was now underwater and excitement from others who saw the lake as a fertile nature sanctuary and sacred site. Yet today, such fears and hopes have not borne out entirely as expected. Along a narrow back road in Kings County, California's agricultural heartland, there are sprouts of grass and thick mud, but no signs of the body of water. Despite the predictions, the lake is nearly gone. Tulare Lake has shrunk to just 2,625 acres, according to the Kings County Office of Emergency Services. Officials expect its imminent disappearance, according to Abraham Valencia with the Office of Emergency Services, saying that barring unforeseen snowmelt runoff causing upstream flooding, the lake covered private land and now some farming is resuming. Tulare Lake has shrunk to just 2,625 acres. According to the Kings County Office of Emergency Services. Most Californians had only known of Tulare Lake from historical accounts. By its endless rows of nut trees, pima cotton, and safflowers, the lake was home to turtles and beavers and was surrounded by tule reeds. The remnants of Tulare Lake are located entirely on private land now. It has reduced rapidly in size as local agencies move water from the lake to nearby farmlands. Evaporation has also played a key role. Pacific Gas and Electric, the area's power utility, undertook a massive effort to retrieve its equipment that was submerged by the lake last year, in some cases using helicopters and dive teams. It has slowly begun restoring services to its customers in the area, which are primarily agricultural customers. Its reemergence is estimated to have caused losses of hundreds of millions of dollars to the area's agriculture industry. Local officials have expressed gratitude that some farmers can resume work. But this won't be the last we hear of Tulare Lake. With the climate crisis intensifying California's wet and dry extremes, the lake will likely continue to return in wet years, according to Jay Lund, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of California, Davis. And allowing the lake to remain could offer benefits by recharging diminishing groundwater and boosting wildlife in the area. The aquifer in the Lake Basin, land that is predominantly owned by the agricultural giant J.G. Boswell Company, has been significantly depleted, which has caused land in the area to sink. A new collaborative effort will provide financial support for healthy soils conservation management practices for citrus farmers in 11 California counties. Citrus growers will be able to enroll in a program that awards up to $200,000 for farm projects to help foster climate resilience and long-term sustainability for California's citrus sector. The effort was made possible after the California Department of Food and Agriculture awarded $5 million from the Healthy Soils Program Block Grant to the California Bountiful Foundation, the California Citrus Quality Council, and the Xerces Society. The California Bountiful Foundation, the 501c3 nonprofit science research and education arm of the California Farm Bureau, is administering all aspects of the program grant. Key program activities include webinars, one-on-one technical assistance, translation services, and direct financial incentives to support the adoption of healthy soils management practices such as cover cropping, conservation cover, reduced tillage, whole orchard recycling, nutrient management, and pollinator-friendly hedgerow plants. The program is set to support 20 to 45 projects over 3 years. A key aspect of the program is its commitment to social equity, with a focus on aiding socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers, women, military veterans, and small-scale farms. Citrus growers in Fresno, Imperial, Kern, Kings, Riverside, San Bernardino, Santa Barbara, Tulare, San Diego, Placer, and Ventura counties are encouraged to enroll. For more information, log on to CaliforniaBountifulFoundation.com. Reedley, California-based Fruit World, a leading fresh produce company, is in a final push of its winter citrus program, harvesting specialty citrus for another month and citrus staples into late April or May. The company says they specialize in delivering the most flavorful fruit in California, including organic and conventional citrus, grapes, stone fruit, and more. Fruit World also hosts large and small-scale citrus programs across North America. The company says they are renowned for their premium organic citrus offerings. They strive for unparalleled taste and quality. Current standout offerings include organic Tango and Murcott mandarins, now available in their newly rebranded high graphic bags, and conventional gold nugget mandarins, which are off the charts sweet, according to Bianca Caparillion, who is the founder and CEO of Fruit World with a Brix above 15. She says they'll continue to harvest navel and Caracara oranges into late April or May, as well as lemons. Fruit World is completing its harvest of organic mineolas and grapefruit, which will only be available for a few more weeks. The celebration of California citrus continues even after the winter, as Fruit World offers year-round lemon and orange programs. Their organic lemons are grown in all three California growing districts, ensuring that customers can enjoy uninterrupted U.S.-grown fruit all year, according to the company. Once their navel oranges are harvested, they seamlessly move into Valencia oranges, providing a year-round California orange supply. In a surprising turn of events, the Cal OSHA Standards Board took an unexpected step by unanimously approving an indoor heat illness prevention regulation, despite being advised to delay the vote. The decision thrust the board into what Autumn Gonzalez, a board chief counsel, described as uncharted territory. The backstory to this circus of a hearing is intriguing in the decision itself, she said. The controversy began when the California Department of Finance withdrew its endorsement of certain sections of the standardized regulatory impact assessment, which is essential for the enactment of any new regulation. The withdrawal specifically targeted sections evaluating the financial impact on public institutions and, by extension, of taxpayers. This development set the stage for a dramatic series of events at a meeting in San Diego, where labor advocates and activists were anticipating the ratification of the regulation they had long championed. Their response to the unexpected setback was swift and disruptive. Protesters vocally and noisily expressed their disapproval, bringing the meeting to a standstill until law enforcement intervened. Then an exasperated board chair, David Thomas, gaveled out and called the meeting adjourned. Later, after a number of citizens had departed the venue, the board reconvened. The board decided to proceed with a vote over CDF's objections. That decision, plus the vote having taken place after the chair struck the gavel to adjourn the meeting, has raised significant questions about its legality. The future of the regulation remains uncertain. An emergency meeting of the board might also be in the cards to finalize the standard before the current rulemaking period concludes in April. If not resolved by then, Cal OSHA would be forced to return to square one on a regulation that has been in development since 2012, with a possibility that the fiscal analysis resubmission could extend beyond the April deadline. Despite the regulatory hurdles and contentious atmosphere, the indoor heat illness prevention standard was passed. However, questions linger about its effect and the implications of the board's unconventional decision.
My Ag Life is brought to you by ICL Growing Solutions, a leading global fertilizer manufacturer and exclusive miner of polyhalite, marketed as polysulfate. Learn more about ICL's cutting-edge crop nutrition solutions at icl-growingsolutions.us.
Compared to 2023, when almond growers struggled with more rainy days and sunny ones during bloom, 2024 proved much better. With bloom finishing on the late varieties in the first half of March, Mel Machado, Vice President of Member Relations for Blue Diamond Growers, described the bloom as okay. What that means in terms of eventual crop load and production is too early to say.
Preceding the bloom, the temperatures have been above normal. January was warm, which in my experience tends to diffuse the bloom a little bit, tend to get a little more scattered between varieties and maybe not the best overlap at the extremes. However, during the bloom, weather was generally favorable. There was a few issues in the San Joaquin Valley with more issues in the Sacramento Valley. They definitely experienced more adverse weather than we did down here in the San Joaquin. But we could say that the bloom was okay. All good blooms have a little bit of weather in them.
To protect flowers and ultimately developing nutlets from fungal diseases, almond growers typically try to apply protective fungicide before rains. Machado said most of them were able to do so, except for some in the Sacramento Valley. Their wet soils may have kept them out of orchards.
When the rain hit up in the Sacramento Valley, it did cause a few more problems up there and kept them out of the fields. Down here, generally able to get pretty good coverage and get the material out that was needed to be applied.
This pollination season, Machado said he hadn't heard any complaints from almond producers about the quality of the bees they used. He had heard from some bee researchers, however, about new viruses that potentially could cause issues, but they're still trying to figure out exactly what's going on.
I've not had any reports of issues from growers or beekeepers. I know speaking with some of the bee researchers around the country, there's been some concern about issues with hives as they came into the bloom. They think they've got some new viruses at play and are really trying to figure out what is going on with bees around the country. But by the time we got to the end of bloom, I had not heard of any issues from any growers here saying they had problems with the bees.
Machado has a rule that he worries about potential freezes until Easter, and it's something that keeps him up at night. This season, because of overall warmer temperatures, he hasn't had those restless nights. Compared to 2023, which was at least a week to 10 days behind normal, he said this year's crop is more in line with average development.
The crop status right now, I'm going to say it's earlier than last year. Again, because of the temperatures, it's the first time in my career where I never had to go out and worry about frost during the bloom and so far in the post-bloom. I've slept well just about every night here. And you know, last night was wondering what was going to happen as the wind died and the skies cleared. But we've not had any issues with the frost. Last year, remember, it was a cold bloom, which delayed the bloom and actually delayed the harvest as well. This year, it appears to be early and crops developing well. We've had some rain over the last couple of days, which always brings with it the threat of disease. We're in the jacket split phase now, and we can get jacket rot and green fruit rot as a result of that. So I know people are out there trying to do the best job they can controlling those diseases. And the best thing we could have would be some wind to clean these trees up and get the jackets out of the trees.
Not all of the crop that is apparent on almond trees right after bloom will be retained. Machado said shortly after bloom, trees will drop those nutlets that weren't fertilized. Later in spring, the trees will jettison additional nuts. This is nicknamed June drop, although it typically occurs in late April. Ultimately, an average almond orchard will only set about 25% of its blooms, depending on variety, environment, and tree health, according to UC studies.
The first drop or the first shed occurs immediately after bloom, where those flowers that didn't get pollinated and fertilized will drop from the trees down to the ground. This bloom was surprisingly strong bud set. You know, a lot of us were concerned about the fertilizer levels and what growers were applying on their orchards last year, given the pricing. But some growers will point out, gee, the trees didn't have a big crop, so they still grew. And we had a pretty strong bud set. And as those come off, it's going to be pretty impressive on the ground when you see the number of flowers and small nuts that have been shed from the tree. At this point, nuts are sizing. You're basically going to keep all the big sizes. And you typically get three sizes. The large ones are going to stay. The small ones are going to fall. And your crop is determined ultimately by how much of that middle size you get to keep. So that's happening right now. And then as we go through the post-bloom period, more into April, that's where the environment that we endure or experience here for the next few weeks comes into play, along with the nutritional status of the trees. And those nuts that the tree feels it can't keep, well, it'll sequester and it'll drop them as well. A lot of people refer to it as the June drop. It actually occurs in April and May. And typically by about the 20th to 25th of April, you can tell what's coming off those trees. They will have been sequestered and cast to the ground. Now, the first clue is going to be that last week or so of April. Again, normally by about the 20th of April, that second shed is really starting to become obvious. And that's when you can see what's going to happen and what's going to stick in the trees. And that's the best time to start putting your guesses out there. And, you know, subjectively, it really is a guess as to what the crop ultimately will be.
And driving around the countryside, Machado said he's not happy with the low level of winter sanitation he has seen. Considered the foundation of naval orange worm management, it involves shaking mummies or nuts left over after harvest that can provide overwintering sites for the pest. A well-known northern San Joaquin Valley PCA has seen similar levels of orchard sanitation. Machado said it's not just the mummy nuts, but the levels of infestation inside the nuts. In one case, a mummy housed 10 naval orange worms.
Well, I had a conversation with that same well-known consultant, and his observations were 49% of the orchards that he'd surveyed, and he looked at hundreds of them here in the northern San Joaquin Valley, had not been sanitized. So I'm going to say you would think with the experience of last year's reject levels due to naval orange worm that people would do a better job of sanitizing. In some cases, they can't get on the ground because of rainfall and their heavy soils. In some cases, they made decisions not to, that they can't afford to get out there and sanitize. Sanitation is the foundation of naval orange worm management, and everything else we do becomes much harder if we don't start with a lower amount of inoculum or moths and worms out in the field left over from poor sanitation job. So I'm not happy with what I'm seeing on sanitation levels out there. On top of that, the infestation of the individual mummies is running pretty high. I've personally seen 10 worms in one mummy. It's easy to find multiples, but 10 sets the record for me. And we found that on a Monterey mummy coming out of Fresno County. But it's all over the place. It's everywhere. It definitely, as I tell growers, you're not behind the eight ball this year. You're behind the bowling ball with the amount of worms that are in these mummies and the amount of mummies in these trees.
For those who didn't perform winter sanitation, Machado said there are a few in-season options, including mating disruption and a mummy spray. Each one has limitations. The choice of treatments also will depend on whether your neighbor performed sanitation. That's because naval orange worm moths are strong flyers. Regardless, he recommended growers make timely hull split sprays using ample volume and following application intervals.
Well, there are a couple of choices. If you didn't get sanitized, there is the option of a mummy spray. Now, that's somewhat controversial. A lot of people think of it as a May spray, but really it needs to go on before May, somewhere in the latter half of April. And the idea is that you get a material applied on the mummies where the moths are going to go back to lay their eggs on again so they can have that next generation grow in the mummy and then come out at hull split. Obviously, mating disruption is a good tool. We know it works. But if you're really on fire, if you have a really high population to start with, mating disruption by itself isn't going to be the cure-all. It's a good tool and it can help, but it's not going to solve a big, bad problem. Ultimately, you're using your hull split treatments that need to be well-timed and well-applied. I want to go back to that mummy spray, though. If you didn't get sanitation and you say, well, okay, a mummy spray is an option, but your neighbor didn't get sanitation, then you've got the neighbor influence, too, or your neighbor's neighbor. Maybe you got good sanitation and you don't think I need it, being the mummy spray. You know, in any event, if you've got pressure coming from the neighbors, from the neighborhood, then the best thing you can do, I'll say, is forego the mummy application and you put the biggest defensive wall you can at hull split. And that means doing the job right, getting the treatment timing right, getting the coverage right, and making sure that you don't lapse in your treatment. If the material is a 14-day material, making sure you're back there in time to get the coverage and ensure you have protection, because you've just got this assault coming in from the neighboring orchards, and that will cause you the problems.
California's 2024 almond crop is off to a good start, but a lot can happen between now and harvest, which historically starts in the South San Joaquin Valley in early August and moves northward. The industry will get the first glimpse of potential production this season with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's subjective almond forecast in mid-May. This is Vicki Boyd reporting for My Ag Life.
By partnering with JCS Marketing Incorporated, your company can achieve 3.5 million impressions to growers, consultants, and industry professionals annually. Our comprehensive media suite, which includes prestigious publications as well as dynamic websites, targeted emails, engaging podcasts, and premier trade shows, provides a strategic platform for targeting key decision makers. This approach can amplify your company's visibility to a specific audience and fosters meaningful connections, positioning your brand at the forefront of the agricultural community. Don't wait for success to come to you. Call our office today at 559-352-4456. That's 559-352-4456.
A House hearing on FY 2025 spending quickly shifted to the Farm Bill and a dispute over the Commodity Credit Corporation Fund, highlighting again the difficulty in writing a new farm law. USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack was again confronted with charges that he is misusing the $30 billion CCC fund.
I've read your comments in news articles over the past few weeks suggesting that you can use CCC funds to help farm safety net programs outside of the regular Farm Bill process. I'm perplexed as to how USDA would be able to do this, as establishing reference prices and farm programs is done by Congress, the legislative branch, not the executive branch.
Harris argued USDA cannot on its own fund new programs from the CCC if there's no new farm bill again this year. But Secretary Vilsack wasted little time in refuting Harris.
I never suggested, nor did I ever say, that we would be using the CCC outside the scope of farm bill discussions and negotiations. What I did say was in order for us to have a farm bill, it's going to be necessary for members of the Ag Committee to be creative how they can use the resources within the CCC at their instruction and direction to be able to provide the relief and assistance they're looking for to bolster our safety net.
The CCC does help fund the ARC, PLC, and Conservation Reserve programs, and Vilsack agreed to a bipartisan Senate ag request last year to use it for trade promotion programs. But Republicans charge Vilsack's using the funds as a political slush fund for pet projects like Climate Smart Ag, and the dispute again shows why it's been hard to achieve a bipartisan farm bill. Farmers and ranchers from across the country descended on Capitol Hill recently to talk about labor challenges. Farm News reporter Chad Smith has more on a decades-long push for a fix.
Farm Bureau members went to Capitol Hill to talk with their senators and representatives about a labor shortage that's reaching critical levels. Arizona farmer John Boltz says the current system of utilizing H-2A workers is no longer viable.
We've been short of workers for well over two decades, and over the last year or two, we've been watching the use of that explode. When we're seeing H-2A used that heavily, we're in crisis mode in U.S. agriculture. It's an expensive program to use. It's bureaucratically challenging, and it takes a reasonable manner of expertise to navigate the system and actually get workers.
He says the farmers went to Capitol Hill to advocate for two key changes.
We're back here asking particularly for a freeze in the adverse effect wage rate that's part of the H-2A program, and asking for a suspension to the disaggregated worker pay rates that was introduced in 2023 so that more farms can stay in business, because we've really gotten to that point where we're so desperate that farms are deciding to shut down.
Boltz is asking other farmers and ranchers to get involved in advocating for a labor fix.
Call and contact their representatives in Congress and talk to folks with the administration about the issue, but also ask their workers and their employees to speak up to change this situation for all employers and employees. And I think the consumer needs to get the message as well. So we need to be talking to consumers, and we need to be talking to our customers.
Learn more at fb.org/labor. Chad Smith, Washington.
Senators Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat from Wisconsin, and Mike Braun, a Republican from Indiana, have introduced new legislation designed to break down barriers to farming and agricultural land ownership. The goal would be to help more Americans pursue farming careers. The bipartisan Farm Transition Act of 2024 would, for the first time, create a commission on farm transitions to study the issues impacting the transition of agricultural operations to the next generation of farmers and ranchers and make recommendations to address those barriers. Farmland is one of our most valuable assets, contributing to local economies, safeguarding our national food security, and putting us on the map with world-class products, according to Baldwin. Many people interested in a career in agriculture are getting locked out and having to compete with Wall Street investment firms buying up farmland. As of 2021, American Farmland Trust says seniors 65 and older owned more than 40% of the agricultural land in the U.S. Having an understanding about the biology of mosquitoes will help in controlling them and minimizing their impacts. USA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
Using a mosquito's own biology to control these pests Penn State University Extension's Jamie Kopko says that is indeed an important consideration regarding control strategies. One example is how far a specific mosquito species can fly.
Some species, especially the ones that kind of go for those real small breeding areas, they tend to stay close to home. So they might never travel more than 100 or 200 yards their entire life. So if you can find where they're breeding and clean that up, you might make a big difference on how many mosquitoes you've got. Where other species of mosquitoes will fly for miles, and especially if like a storm system rolls through, the wind might blow them some. So you can be like, we're getting hit by all these mosquitoes all summer long and we can't find any breeding sites. Well, yeah, their breeding site might actually be a marshy area 2 miles upwind and they're all just blowing in.
There are also potential mosquito treatment methods based on biology homeowners can perform on their own. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Panama Canal is currently facing a severe drought, with Gatun Lake, its primary water source, recording historically low levels. The situation is expected to persist until May. The drought, exacerbated by an El Nino year, is compelling cargo ships to seek alternative, longer routes, thereby increasing carbon emissions. Cargo shipping, a significant contributor to global greenhouse gases, is thus under scrutiny for its environmental impact. The drought is also intensified by human-induced global warming, which amplifies the frequency and severity of extreme weather events. Furthermore, Panama's growing demand for clean drinking water sourced primarily from Gatun Lake adds to the crisis, highlighting the multifaceted challenges posed by the current drought.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.